Hello, and welcome to the Popmatic Podcast. I'm Brian.
And I'm Crystal. We're librarians at Nashville Public Library.
This podcast is where you can find reviews and recommendations of the best books, movies, and music available for checkout from the Popular Materials Department of the Nashville Public Library.
You can also learn about library programs such as concerts, film screenings, book clubs, author talks, and book signings.
Today I bring you an interview with author Sherry Priest, whose novel Bone Shaker just won the Locus Award. Her other books include Fathom and the Eden Moore series. She'll be appearing at Dragon Con in Atlanta, September 3rd through the 6th.
So congratulations on winning the Locus Award.
Thank you.
Hopefully that boosts some sales and definitely boosted some library circulation, and it's good hype for Dreadnought when it comes out. But for anyone who hasn't read Bone Shaker yet, what would you like them to know?
Well, it's a fun retro science fiction story that is kind of epic and crosses a whole lot of genres, but at the same time, it's really just a story about this woman and her kids. So there's zombies and strange machinery and a walled city filled with poisonous gas and a bunch of people who have a community underground. And there's an evil genius, mad scientist, and I don't know, just a lot of really fun stuff. But at its core, I think it's a very simple story, so people are finding it rather surprisingly accessible.
It seemed like you were trying to subvert the teenage boy hero quest motif a little bit. Was that intentional?
No, not really. I have a younger brother who is much, much younger than me, and by which I mean I'm in my mid-30s and he's still in college. And so growing up, when I looked after him and I spent a lot of time around him and his friends, it just seemed really natural to write a teenage guy character for me for this project. And I did kind of want to have a teenage guy character who wasn't magical. He's not a prince. He's not, you know, he's really not special in any way. And he's not even really that smart, bless his heart. he makes a lot of mistakes and he learns as he goes along. And I really just kind of wanted him to be not an average Joe, because he's not an average Joe, but somebody who wasn't singled out for greatness. I think it's really interesting when everybody else gets a shot at, you know, being in the center of a story.
It did seem like there was a moment where Zeke realizes that, you know, he can't figure everything out. He's not in control, and I found that very refreshing as a reader.
Oh, good. Yeah, he's got a lot less control than he even thinks he does. But I hope that it's also apparent that kind of when he realizes that, that's when he actually starts to get a handle on the situation. Understanding exactly how little is within his purview leads him to being a much more effective character, I think. So.
And what was your inspiration for the walled city with poison on the inside?
Well, I live in Seattle now. I haven't lived here terribly long, only a few years. I actually moved there from Tennessee. And I'm from Florida originally, and so for the first couple years in particular in Seattle, I felt like everything was very dark and gray and wet all the time, and I stayed inside a lot. And it kind of actually grew out of that, just this feeling of being indoors all the time and that everything outside is unfriendly to you in a way. Seattle's kind of a really strange kind of weather city. For about 9 months out of the year, it's 50 degrees and raining, and for about 6 weeks, it's unbearably cold and wet and miserable, and for about 6 weeks it's really beautiful. So you spend a lot of time with everything very uniform and kind of unfriendly to someone like me, who's accustomed to it much, much brighter and warmer. So kind of beyond that, I just really liked zombies and I wanted to put zombies here, and it all of these ideas just kind of collided really into a walled city filled with the Walking Dead. So there you go.
And you're calling this setting the Clockwork Century, so it's sort of a steampunk alternative history United States.
Yes, that's correct.
And the next book in this setting is Dreadnought?
Yes, that's the next one from Tor. I released one called Clementine through an independent press, but it was just a novella. It's kind of a side story. But the next big release, yes, is Dreadnought, and it will be out at the end of September.
And do you want to say anything about that? Will we meet any of the same characters we met in Boneshaker or Clementine?
A few of them will definitely turn up. Really, the number one thing, piece of feedback I got with regards to Boneshaker was people wanted to see more of this universe because it's very compact, you know. It's set in this very small you know, just within 2 square miles of Seattle. And a lot is implied. Like, there's a lot of stuff going on outside the wall. You know, the Civil War is still going on, even though it's 1880. And just a lot of people wanted to see what was going on outside the wall. So I thought the most obvious and probably efficient way to do this would be to start a story back east. And so at the end of Bone Shaker, there's a character who who seems to be pretty popular. I get a lot of questioning email about him, who has an accident. He's very badly hurt. And he sends a message back east to a daughter who he has back there, and he asks her if she'll come see him, because he's afraid he's on his deathbed, and he wants to see his daughter one last time. And she's a nurse in a Confederate hospital in Richmond, so she undertakes the cross-country journey to make it to Seattle. And there are steampunk Texas Rangers and undead Mexican separatists and battle mechs and a Union war train called the Dreadnought.
And Clementine, it came out on Subterranean Press?
It did. That's correct.
It's almost sold out, or is sold out?
It is effectively sold out, but it's going to be re-released in trade paperback next year.
Okay, okay. And if anyone doesn't know, Subterranean puts out like very, very nice hardback editions of books, and they're worth investing in. We get them here at the library, and I'm always impressed.
Excellent.
So you're somewhat famous for writing listing your word count, like, per day on your blog. A lot of people comment about that. I mean, are you afraid that will backfire?
Well, no. I mean, it's a way of holding myself accountable as much as anything. And the truth is, I have a part-time day job and a lot of writing deadlines, so I have to be very compartmentalized about my day. You know, the morning hours get day job attention, and then I break for lunch, and then I do writer business. You know, I answer emails and phone calls and mail packages and do all that usual stuff, and then in the afternoons, I sit down and write. And that kind of organization does not come naturally to me. It took me lots of time to kind of get into the swing of that. And posting the word counts every day, it's first of all, it makes me feel like I've accomplished something. and also, it's, I don't know, lots of people who are writing stuff or who want to be writers will read my thing and go, oh, well, that doesn't seem like much, you know, a few thousand words a day. But if you do a few thousand words every single day, or even most days, within about 3 or 4 months, you have a full-length manuscript. And people very often ask about, you know, well, what's your process, your writing process? Well, I don't really have a writing process. My writing process is, you know, put my butt in the chair and try to tell a story that doesn't suck. But the only way that happens is a little bit at a time every single day. So when people want to talk about what it looks like being a professional writer, the truth is it's kind of tedious. It's every single day you do this much work. And when it's your job and when you live and die by deadlines, that's just what you do. That's just what it looks like. So, and if I'm doing my part to kind of take the glamorous shine off of the writing profession, then I'm sorry. But, you know, it is what it is.
The other part of being a writer, too, is going out and meeting your fans and doing book tours. And so you're going to be at Dragon Con on Labor Day weekend?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
In my experience, like, whenever time I go to SF conventions, it seems like a boy party. And, like, as a woman, like, how do you feel about going to science fiction conventions?
Well, I really, really enjoy it. Historically speaking, there is certainly that perception that it's kind of a guy's club. But that's really, really changing. And I'm personally very proud to be part of that. I was having a conversation with some other writer friends of mine who are women, and we're all about the same age. You know, we're in our you know, mid-30s to early 40s. And we kind of feel like we're this first generation of women who were raised with science fiction archetypes that we could plug into. You know, we had Wonder Woman and Princess Leia and Ellen Ripley and Sarah Connor. And we didn't have this idea that there wasn't a place for us in science fiction and fantasy and horror. So now that we're old enough and now that we're publishing, you know, there are a lot more women writing and there are a lot more women reading this stuff and a lot more women coming to these events. Dragon Con is very close to 50-50, I'd say, you know, men to women. And also, I love seeing people bring their kids out. You know, it just tickles me pink to see the next generation of geeks being brought up right.
And are you a gamer?
Well, I used to do some role-playing games, but I don't do it so much anymore. I just don't have time.
Yeah, there's a lot of time.
Yeah.
I guess, are you into cosplay? Because it seems like a lot of your PR photos, it seems like you're always dressed very elaborately.
I really enjoy playing dress-up, yes. I don't really do anything to a specific fandom or character. When I was younger, I was very much a goth. I loved the theatricality of it and the big clothes and, you know, just the fun and expressiveness of it. And steampunk, I think, appeals to a lot of people who used to be goth, because now that we're older, the whole idea of being theatrically sad that comes with, you know, the goth subculture is a little harder to work when you're 35 and have a day job and have bills and children, you know. But the desire to be theatrical does not go away. And the desire to play dress-up doesn't go away. And so I really, really enjoy breaking out all the fun clothes and crazy clothes. And I have, I think, 2 full suitcases of them at this point and a bunch of stuff hanging in the closet that if I wear it around town, people look at me funny, and sometimes I care and sometimes I don't, but I always bring it to the conventions. So
the things I was hearing from Gen Con was that everyone dresses steampunk, and that, you know, a few years ago it was like just all Star, both Trek and Wars, and now it's steampunk. Like, that's how everyone's dressing. So, I mean,
it's a lot of fun. I mean, you get to take Victorian influences, or you can combine it with other things. Like, you see sometimes the steampunk Star Wars costumes and the like. It's, steampunk is very, very participatory. I did SteamCon last year out here in Seattle. That's actually at SeaTac out at the airport. And, I mean, you got to understand, I do a lot of conventions. I probably do, I did maybe, oh, maybe 10 of them last year. I'm probably doing 12 or 13 this year. And SteamCon was by far the most dressed up convention I had ever been to. Because very often you have, you know, maybe a quarter of the people show up in really great costumes, and a quarter of the people show up kind of, you know, in fan t-shirts or something like that, and everybody else is kind of dressed normal. Probably a good 90% of the people who attended SteamCon were dressed up steampunk. And it was so much fun and so crazy that there were actually people who were staying at the hotel who weren't part of the convention who came downstairs to see what we were doing and bought memberships to come participate in it.
It seems like, you know, the 19th century aesthetic is, like, tied in with fashion intrinsically. So it lends itself that way. And I guess, too, if you're dressing up like someone from a famous movie or TV show, you know, there's a very precise model you're going for, where if you're just being creative and doing whatever you want to do, it's open-ended.
Well, it is. I often joke that no two steampunks ever arrive at a party wearing exactly the same thing. You know, because so many of them sew, or they make their own jewelry, or they, you know, they create their own costumes, they make their own accessories, and it's very much, you know, it ties in really nicely to the do-it-yourself movement, to the makers movement, if you know what I'm talking about, with like Maker Magazine and things like that. And also, I think it's very timely because you have, you know, the another thing I like to say about steampunk, one of my sound bites for it is that if it has a philosophy, it's reduce, reuse, and recycle. It's this idea that you find new uses for things that you would otherwise throw away. And so I think it's very timely. It just, it really, really appeals to a lot of different things that are very popular right now and still allows you to play dress up.
I guess when we started having this conversation, it seems like some people, if you say steampunk, they just know exactly what you mean. Like, they did totally get it. And other people are like, what is that? So
you can
pass on this question if you want, if you're like, you know, you don't want to talk about it. So if you had to say, someone asked you, well, what's steampunk, like, what would you say?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't mind being asked at all. My answer to it is that steampunk is a style. It's a style of clothes, of books, of movies, of video games. It's very popular in video games. And music that draws its inspiration from the science fiction of the 19th century. So you're talking like Jules Verne and H.G. Wells and, you know, Mary Shelley with Frankenstein and all of that stuff. And basically, it's pretending that you have the technology from a time when steam was the dominant form of the hip, the now, the powerful, the important. So in some ways, you could say it's the science fiction of a future that never happened, because the people who were writing science fiction back then, you know, they didn't have any concept of, you know, the microchip, or sometimes even the internal combustion engine, or the internet, obviously. So they imagine that the future is going to be steam-powered. So that's what steampunk is, basically, in a nutshell. But it's something that people like to fight over a lot. You know, lots of people like to bicker over exactly what steampunk means, but I don't like to do that because my philosophy is, if you're not having fun, you're doing it wrong. And I don't enjoy sitting around arguing with people who want to be, you know, really nitpicky about rules for it. So I say, everybody go have a good time. You know, don't worry about it.
I think in a few years, too, you know, its tropes are just going to be absorbed into, like, science fiction or fantasy fiction the same way, like, cyberpunk was or did. I mean, nowadays, if you write a science fiction novel, you know, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, you might say it was cyberpunk, but now we don't think about it in that way anymore.
That's true. Actually, though, steampunk has kind of been around for a really long time, and you can mostly blame Disney. But you can also talk about, well, I don't mean that even in a pejorative way, but the early days of film were very drawn to horror and science fiction, you know, the old black and whites and the silent movies. I mean, in the 20s and 30s, you have people doing movie versions of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and then Disney did one also. And, you know, there were TV shows, Wild Wild West, a TV show in the 60s, and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and I mean, there has been this logical progression of it where it has been an undercurrent in pop culture for a really long time. You could look at the video game Arcanum from the 80s, which is a really good example of it. And, oh, I would even point at, what was that TV show that Bruce Campbell did? It was like You Don't Know Jack or Jack of All Trades or something. I don't know. I mean, it's been around for a while. I think the reason, if it gets reabsorbed into science fiction or you know, modern fantasy or urban fantasy or whatever at some point, I think that will happen if there isn't a big iconic piece of steampunk work. Like right now, if you say, oh, science fiction, you know, kind of a cyberpunk-y sort of deal, well, like The Matrix, you know, and people go, oh, yeah, well, I know what that looks like. Or if you want to talk about fantasy, you go, oh, well, kind of like Lord of the Rings, and people go, oh, yeah, I know what that looks like. But at the moment, steampunk doesn't have anything to point at that has enough pop culture recognition. Like we can say, oh, well, it's like The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, but the comic, not the movie, please. Or it's like the movie Wild Wild West with Will Smith, except like everything it looks like, but that's a terrible movie, so not that. So really what steampunk is looking for right now is something that everyone can point at and say, look, it's like that. And we'll see if that happens or not. I mean, I certainly hope it happens. I hear that J.J. Abrams has picked up the rights to Boilerplate by Paul Guinan and Ina Bennett. And I would love to see that become a big project because it's a really good book, and it could be, I mean, it could be the one. It could be the thing that really breaks through and puts it in the popular consciousness. So we'll see what happens, I suppose.
If people wanted to learn more, where would you recommend them searching?
Well, there are a lot of them. There's not really one great hub. Well, like there's a steampunk fashion community on LiveJournal. It's just called Steam Fashion, where a lot of people go to show off the things that they've made or that they're making or their costumes that they're building. And that's kind of a roundabout way of learning a lot about it. There are also the Brass Goggles forums, which I believe is actually a British site where they have kind of become a compendium for that. And Jake Von Slatt, who does the steampunk workshop, he's got a website. I believe he's based out of, California, maybe Portland. But anyway, he does a lot of the build-it-yourself, customize-it-yourself stuff. It's really very, very interesting. And I believe coming out next year, Jeff Vandermeer is doing a project called the Steampunk Bible through Abrams Press. And that's kind of looking to be the big compendium. Actually, Jeff and Ann Vandermeer have several books already that are collections of steampunk short fiction, so that's another good place to start.
I was thinking, too, of Coil House Magazine.
Oh, yes, Coil House. That's a good one.
I mean, that's a really good website. You go to coilhouse.net and just, you know, you can just browse the tag for steampunk, and you'll see all kinds of examples of, you know, art and fashion and literature.
So Boing Boing is also very keen on all things steampunk, but and not everything they do is steampunk. But if you go looking for steampunk on Boing Boing, you'll turn up a whole lot of stuff.
Indeed. Well, I think that's time. Was there anything specifically you wanted me to plug?
Well, Dreadnought will be out September 28th, so people are more than welcome to pick that up. And I'm actually going to be in Virginia very shortly after the book comes out. The book begins in Virginia, so when we were approached by a store in Virginia for doing an event, my publisher actually agreed to send me to it. I'm going to be at the Fountain Bookstore in Richmond, Virginia on November 16th, and I will be at Dragon Con over Labor Day weekend. I'm going to try and get back to Chattanooga next year sometime, do some signings around Tennessee. So
the Southern Festival of Books every October here in Nashville.
Yeah, I know.
A lot of authors.
But my October is such a mess right now. I'm doing one out-of-country event, three out-of-state events, seven local events, and then two more out-of-state events in November. Because, you know, the book comes out at the end of September, so it's kind of the big push to
get it out there. Yep, that's when you're going to hit it really hard.
Yeah, but I would love to go do the thing in Nashville. I mean, I lived in Chattanooga for about 12 years before we came out here, so I'm actually pretty familiar with what you guys have going on out there.
I guess, could I slip in one more question?
Sure.
What was it like being goth in Chattanooga?
It was sometimes silly and sometimes fun, and actually mostly I was a goth in Florida, which was much trickier, because I got to tell you, when you're wearing head-to-toe black and it's, you know, 104 degrees, it's just awkward for everyone. But I played a lot of vampire when I lived in Chattanooga, actually. We used to go, I'm not making this up, our local chapter would go and meet with the Nashville chapter, and we would run Vampire the Masquerade games in the Grand Ole Opry Hotel. We would pick a lobby and just all meet up there, and nobody ever said anything to us. It was awesome.
If you want to learn more about Sherry and her work and most of the things we talked about today, just visit her website at sherrypriest.com.